Certainly appreciate all of the good things that Senator Laird has done for our community, but this legislation initiated by his office without any consultation with us, so much so that we were kind of caught by surprise that it existed. That part not appreciated, but it means that our CUP is essentially not enforceable. And so we don't appreciate that lack of consultation. By we, I mean the city manager, myself, Councilmember Peak, we had a meeting with Echo Management, and we talked a little bit about some of the neighborhood concerns. And one of the things we've talked about is we'd rather than people hang out in the median waiting for services that they actually be allowed onto the campus earlier, so they're not hanging out in the median or hanging out front, et cetera, although that's on us, with stolen shopping carts and that sort of thing. But is that something we can put into the management plan? You kind of talked about hours, to where we could change, not only allow but encourage them to allow people on campus sooner, so they're not hanging out in front. Where could we put that?
I believe that could be in the operations and management plan.
Okay. Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to defer to Councilmember Newsom. Other questions?
And the operation management side of that, I think originally we established the certain times at 4 p.m. because we were trying not to conflict with the school time. How does that, have we done any outreach or communicated with the school district in regards to SB 340 as well as the operational standpoint, to see how that impacts that corridor?
We have not yet done that. This is brand new and only came up just very recently as we were doing the final stages of this zoning update. So we haven't had time, and so we haven't changed anything on our end, and we haven't had a discussion yet with Echo in terms of modifying their operations and management plan yet. So,
and I think
those are all things that need to happen.
This bill was just passed in the session year 2025 to 2026. How did the latest Echo meeting go with the standards of operation and the CUP discussion?
They had a neighborhood meeting just this past week, but we did not discuss the operations and management plan yet for this year, so we've yet to do that.
So the community and the neighborhood around there thinks it's governed by the CUP, but we're just now finding out it's not governed by CUP, only operations.
Correct. The operations and management plan is pretty thorough. It does go over all of the site things. It just doesn't cover the meal program and shower program, which, yes, those are the folks that aren't living in the shelter. So,
and that's what the neighborhood has the most complaints about.
Yes, likely.
Okay, thank you.
Councilmember Funk.
Yeah, I want to circle back onto this hours of operations question, because I've heard feedback from the neighbors and, the concerns about folks congregating in the median area or outside the shelter waiting for services or having come from services, and that that's a major concern to the neighborhood. And Echo was saying, well, the city doesn't allow us to be open for our shelter clients before 4 p.m. What I read in, and you were, I don't know what you were doing, what I'm seeing in page 92 of 470 of the zoning code, ES operating standards, shelter hours of operation are limited to between 4 p.m. and 9 a.m. daily, period. Shelter clients and the general public are not permitted on the premises outside these hours unless otherwise permitted by the approval of a conditional use permit. Okay, so that's what's in the language now that's being proposed. Are we looking to make a change in that language? Because the council had this discussion years ago when we authorized 24/7 operations for Echo, because we had you know, mothers with toddlers, you know, out in 105 degree heat who couldn't put their kids to bed for a nap in the afternoon. And we had clients working to get themselves employed who had job offers on night shifts, who needed to, if they were resident, needed to be able to sleep during the day to have their night shift jobs and get themselves together so they could go for housing. So this is, the council approved that 24/7 operation years ago.
So I believe the original language referred to a conditional use permit. This language you see on the screen is actually in the new zoning. So we adapted this already to the Senate bill to change CUP to on-site management plan. So the on-site management plan can govern your hours. The CUP is now null and void. So I think they're currently operating under their previous CUP, and we need to have the discussion now that that isn't valid and that they can create an on-site management plan in conjunction with the city to allow for those folks to go on earlier, if that's what we want to do.
Right. There are a number of things here where there's ambiguity about who is a shelter client, because the operations and the management plan is clear that you have different categories of clients. You have clients who are residing at the shelter and who have access to their residence 24/7. And you have clients who are coming and going for meal programs or showers or other meetings, job training, other kinds of services that might be subject to different sets of requirements.
To be clear, though, this evening we're just adopting this language regarding acknowledging that the CUP is no longer enforceable. I mean, I think it may be that we have enough questions here that we need to talk about this some more regarding the management plan. I think the key thing, at least for a lot of us, is that they're encouraged. And when we met with them, they seemed certainly open to the idea of allowing people on campus sooner, but that previously that was not allowed. So they seemed open to it, and I'd like to see us kind of head there for some of the reasons mentioned by Councilmember Funk and myself. But I don't know that we have time to go into all of these particular issues this evening.
This Senate bill really triggers the need for the city to review a new operations and management plan. Right. And that is a whole nother can of worms. Not really a can of worms. It's a whole nother thing to do that we aren't doing right now. That's correct. So tonight we're just looking for your recommendation on how we implement this part of the state law, this narrow little bit, which we have to put in there. And then we can, if we'd like, at the council's pleasure, we can come back to have a broader discussion. But I think, as was alluded to earlier, we haven't done outreach with the schools. We haven't talked to ECHO yet. This is brand new. We have work to do on that. And that's another separate activity that exceeds the scope of the zoning update right now.
But I'm as a larger piece of feedback on the zoning code update, I think part of what's really confusing in this work is that you've got a lot of detail in the zoning code around the operations of the shelter. And then you have a management plan that can make exceptions to those things and has more detail going on in contrary things. And it creates a lot of confusion of folks about what to expect. So I would encourage staff to think about having the zoning code itself be much more limited and rely more heavily on the management plan, and then simultaneously to put a structure in place where that the discussion of the management plan is then part of the, of the ask ECHO to do that at the annual meeting and report back to this council on an annual basis that the staff has reviewed that, discussed it with ECHO, received feedback from the neighborhood, and does or does not have any recommendations for this council. That would let people know that somebody's minding the store from the city perspective as we're working to handle the impact of this very important usage on the neighborhood around it and on others who are affected.
I tend to agree with that. you know, the zoning code is minimal language, and the day-to-day be in the management plan. Does that make sense to you as staff?
Sorry, could you repeat the first part of that?
The zoning code, you know, is more limited in terms of its specificity, in that the specifics are more in the management plan.
Yes, it has general terms, and then the very finite specifics are in the management plan. And it's done that way purposely because the needs change from year to year through ECHO on how they want to handle things. And they wanted to keep that more fluid rather than have it locked into an ordinance.
Right. And I think that's good for the city too, is it not?
Yes.
I hear what you're saying, though, because in my meeting today with Councilmember Funk, we did review the full zoning ordinance. And there are a lot of very specific things in there about that I think could probably be put into the management plan. So I think if the direction from the council is for us to look at that with only the land use things, remove the CUP, which is the discussion, and put as much into the management plan as possible, I hear you on that. Yeah. That's what you...
I think that would help us keep this a lot cleaner. And then if, you know, when there's, you know, some tweak, we don't have a disconnect between the zoning code and that. And for the zoning code, what I was relying on in this discussion was what was available at the link report provided by staff in the staff report on this item.
Thank you. I'm going to go back to Councilmember Newsom, and I'm going to go over here to the other side.
I have a question. So when the legislation gets put into place, like this one was enacted in January 1st of 2026, what is the time frame for the city to evaluate what's been passed and to implement it into the existing activities of the city?
You'll probably notice a wry smile on my face. The legislature expects cities to implement it immediately because that's when the legislation goes into effect. Practically speaking, there's a ramp-up period of time, and cities can take several years depending on the nature of the legislation. But as you're probably aware, in the housing arena, they're constantly updating. Every year we get a new series of housing bills, and it's impossible to keep up the pace that Sacramento has been able to keep in some of those bills. So cities, until they get either an inquiry or a lawsuit against them, there's no specific time frame that they're forced to do this by, unless there's some funding attached to it at the state level.
So ECHO came to us, I believe, in 2026 to extend their programs, and this Senate bill was already enacted. We didn't know about it when we added those additional CUP changes because we weren't forced to implement it as a city for up to several years because we're tasked with too many bills, not enough coming off, and adding new ones on top of the layers for us.
Yeah, there's approximately, I think the last legislative session, there's about 4,300 bills that went through the legislature. Obviously, not all of them were signed by the governor, but there's a significant volume of legislation coming out. To give you a little bit of contrast, the state of Nevada's legislature, I don't know if it's the same case as now, but they used to meet every other year, and they only met for 6 weeks. California has a full-time professional legislature, and so that's their business. They are constantly making the bills. And for smaller cities, we try to keep up through League of California Cities. CSAC will provide some references for the cities to follow as well. But it is a significant task to keep up with all the legislation that's coming out of Sacramento.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mayor Pro Tem Daris, any question? Okay, Councilmember Peak.
Man, I lost my train of thought. In terms of the hours, we did have this ex parte discussion, and I'm not going to speak for them, but they seem open to the idea of having people in the courtyard before 4 o'clock. I would be very much in favor of that. In terms of, like, I can't speak on the record how many neighbors know about the elimination of our ability to enforce CUPs. But there are handfuls of them that are aware of that, Councilwoman Newsom, just so you're aware that I know that they're aware. And some of them are not too pleased about it. I would be in favor of making it more streamlined in the zoning ordinance than having the management plan be more of the massaged product. So, and I would also, in terms of the wording, I don't know if that precludes people that live there from putting their baby to sleep. I mean, I'm totally fine with people being in the building all day. I mean, if they're living there, you know, but I think in terms of people that are coming there for services, a couple extra hours, you know, just to discourage loitering. And that's kind of what our topic was, one of the topics of the meeting was on sidebar meeting.
Okay, thank you. Any public comment?
To make this quicker, if you can answer one quick question, then I might be able to sit down. Is this only for Echo, or is this for all shelters?
This is only for, I mean, Echo is our only shelter. So
emergency shelters are only allowed in the emergency shelter overlay zone, which we only have one emergency shelter overlay zone, which is where Echo is, if that answers that question.
Right, but if there are other, you know, like overnight shelters opening in the winter at a church, let's say, I don't know if the question pertains to that, but it could pertain.
Those are different.
Those are separate.
Those are regulated under emergency warming or,
right.
or yeah,
right.
it's a
they don't operate provision. Under previously yeah. under a CUP or anything like that.
Yeah.
They just operate as a right, as a part of their religious mission,
yeah.
if you will.
Exactly.
Got it. All right. Thank you. We will then bring it back. I think our primary comment was simply let's minimize the wording and keep the ordinance as simple as possible. And we need to revisit and revise and incorporate all these things into the management plan and work with Echo on that.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Let's move on to the next topic.
Parking. I love parking. Yeah, I often say if I was king for a day, I'd probably just eliminate all of the parking standards. I say this to Kelly all the time and she cringes. But I think there's cities that have done that. It's kind of an interesting experiment. I don't think we're ready to do that. But it's not what we're recommending here at all. What we basically have is we've refined our definitions in our land use ordinance, our draft land use ordinance, to respond to the new general plan. The new general plan has what's called place types, and the new zoning has place types or different land uses. In addition, after taking a look at our parking, it has a bunch of outdated stuff. So we've streamlined it. We've gotten rid of the overlapping standards, some antiquated references that were in there. We have come up with some really easier flat ratios for certain things, like 3 spaces per 1,000. Some unique ones that for strange land uses, and then some allowances for changes that are less than 2,500 square feet without redoing their parking, We also added some standards for large retail stores. Whenever we get a large retail store, they always want to put in a lot more than they actually need. Walmart was famous for doing that, hundreds and hundreds of extra spaces. So we're proposing a 10% cap on that, on the excess parking. But just having a look at it, this is our existing code, for example. And there's a section of the proposed code. I'm not putting it all in here because there's a lot, but these are the more common ones. And basically what we had before was these turnover rates that were in there, and we had sort of some strange regulations. We've made it now just very clean. 1 space per 400, 1 space for 200, 1 space per 4 beds for medical services, for example. Just really straight lined it. So and that's really about it. It's again, I think this is getting into the streamlining and really just matching the new land uses. I'll end there and be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, I'm going to start on my left this time. Councilmember Peak, any questions?
I like this.
Okay, that's succinct. Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem Daris. Okay, Councilmember Funk.
Yeah, what I'm trying to interpret is for most commercial uses, does this require them to have more parking or less parking than on average than the existing?
Very similar, maybe a little less for a couple uses, but very similar.
Okay, similar and simpler.
Yes.
Great. Councilmember Newsom.
No question.
Okay, just to be clear for me, it says residential parking standards remain unchanged, so you still have to have parking for residential.
That doesn't change. Yeah, that's the critical one. It's based on bedrooms
and then
per unit and guests.
This is throughout the city except downtown, correct? Because downtown, we don't require parking for commercial properties, correct?
Or Well, we do for some commercial uses. So downtown, we don't require parking for retail or restaurant.
Okay.
We do require parking for office and residential.
Okay.
Or other land uses that are above the ground floor.
Okay, right. That's what I want to make sure you understand. But so these comments really pertain primarily to outside the downtown area. Okay, wanted to be clear on that. Okay, thank you. And if, well, relative to downtown, though, in terms of businesses needing to find spaces for a residential project, if their lot is too small, and we have many small lots on in downtown, if their lot is too small, literally too small, really, to park, to put any parking on it, this doesn't address that. But that is something we could and maybe should address at some point in time in the future?
Yes, there's several ways that can be done. Right now, we already do have an off-site parking allowance with a use permit. They can do that today.
Okay.
They can do that with the new code as well. But other options, if we wanted to be more supportive of economic development, or for that matter, mixed-use development in the downtown, we can look at things such as an in-lieu fee program, or we could look at things such as other off-site parking.
Right. Okay.
And a lot of communities utilize those processes. But we don't have that yet.
Okay. Thank you. We'll see. Any public comment on this? Okay. Seeing none, we'll bring it back to council. I think we've indicated we're okay with what you've suggested here. Okay, very good. Let's move on to the next item, design review.
One of my favorite hearings to always go to was the design review committee. And I say was because we haven't had a design review committee meeting in quite some time. And that's because, partly because of state law, partly because of some of our own changes to streamline development review. But what state law has done is it's required us to adopt things called objective design standards. Which basically allows a lot of larger, especially housing projects, by right, as long as they meet a set of objective standards, a list of standards. But in addition to that, our city council has spoken and said, we want the process to be cheaper and easier for development to happen. We trust staff with the basic design elements of a small commercial building. But what I'll also tell you is a lot of larger development projects, a lot of larger commercial projects, already have to go through a conditional use permit or come to city council or do a rezoning or do a map. And so that in itself allows for a design review process. So the question was, do we still need a design review committee if we haven't utilized it in about a year? And I think we've heard from the council, and I think that, you know, maybe it's time that we take that off and we give that duty to the community development department. Now, the DRC, it's been great. It served a great purpose in its time. And I think those council members and others that have staffed it have done an amazing job. And it's been an absolute delight. And it's served its purpose well. And we've seen a lot of great projects that have been improved. And I think originally it was brought forward as a way to streamline projects, really, because I think there was a thought that they were being held up too long, you know, on the other end of things, and hey, let's get this through and make this happen. So the recommendation here is to eliminate design review, but really just basically passing that duty off to the Planning Commission or the City Council, or for really small projects, back to the Community Development Department. Happy to answer your questions on that.
Okay, I'm going to start on my left again with Councilmember Peak.
I'm in favor of this.
Okay, thank you. Mayor Pro Tem Daris.
Yeah, I think the simple fact that Design Review Committee hasn't had to meet in a year and a half or so proves that the objective design standards are doing what we hope they would. So, yeah, I'm in favor of simplifying this as much as possible.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and ask my questions now before I go down the aisle or down the row. You know, as I understood it, the original purpose of the DRC was to give the project applicant kind of a free look from two planning commissioners, two council members, and a member of the public. You know, and the city does not charge for DRC meetings and or reviews, and which is very nice of us compared to other cities who would have that required step in the process and charge money for those reports and reviews. My only concern here would be essentially we do away with this, which is always a nice step to do away with a body. Be more efficient. But if we push it to think certain things to the Planning Commission, we do charge applicants for Planning Commission reviews. because you got to write up a staff report, et cetera, et cetera. And so, but overall, I mean, it seems like a good idea to be streamlining, but is it going to push, how many things would be pushed upwards to the Planning Commission versus, in theoretical, no offense, but downwards to the Community Development Director?
Or downhill. Let me correct that, because we wouldn't be pushing things to the Planning Commission that wouldn't normally go. So okay. The Planning Commission is only mentioned there because those projects would be going there anyway, okay. Whether it's for a map, whether it's for something else, rezoning, plan development, master plan development, those things that would go anyway.
Okay.
That's where that would take place. So we wouldn't put something there if it didn't have that other process.
Great answer. Thank you. And I'd like to thank our public member of the thing, Emily Baranek, who is here this evening. Thank you for your service on that body. Okay. I'll pass it down to Councilmember Funk.
Thanks. As current chair of the Design Review Committee, I was going to have this on my list of recommendations for our strategic planning because we have worked ourselves out of a job, basically, in simplifying the processes to the point where that isn't needed. So I would just, to the mayor's point, that was an early process. I can only, in the last 3.5 years or so when I've been chair, I can only recall one project that came to DRC specifically for that kind of discussion. It was an applicant that was reluctant to do the extensive amount of curb gutter and sidewalk and undergrounding and things that were required on that on a particular property and needed some further discussion about how those things might be interpreted. Can you think of any others that any additional volume that we've had of projects that were just somebody who really wanted to get a read from council members and planning commissioners and a member of the public about how something would go over?
I seem to recall we did quite a process with La Plaza and some of these other earlier large commercial projects around town. Trying to think of the other ones that came forward with that, where it really became a good collaborative process.
Yeah, it's had its moment and served us well.
Yeah.
I just think we're done with that now.
Yeah.
And we could at least plan to eliminate it. And then should we find a need for some kind of guidance, perhaps we could do a less formal process, because two council members, two planning commissioners, and a volunteer from the public would not constitute a Brown Act majority of any body. So you could just convene a little task force to chat with somebody if someone needed that. Will that suffice, you think, to handle any need that developers have to be able to kick it around a little bit before they close escrow on a project or otherwise?
Yes, I believe our team, our community development team, can do a great job doing that. And if need be, we could even bring a, some really unique proposal to council if we had to. If there was a very big land use proposal, a very big change in something happening, we would preliminary review that with council anyway. So,
fair enough.
Okay, Councilmember News.
Thank you. I appreciated my time on DRC. I think we saw Barrel Creek. We saw a lot of big projects that come through DRC. So I will miss that aspect of it because I felt like you were there from the beginning. But I know that this has been needed for a long time. So I appreciate staff bringing that forward.
Okay, any members of the public wishing to comment? Okay, seeing none, we'll bring it back to council. I think we've made clear we support this thing, and I think it's another example of a task order being streamlined and efficient, and I compare that to another city south of us where they have 14 advisory bodies.
That is a long process.
About 70
people. I speak from experience.
Fill out financial disclosure forms and everything else. Okay. Let's move on to the next topic.
And now I'm going to introduce Kelly Gleason, our planning manager, and she's going to take you through some of the more difficult items since I just did the easy ones. Here you are.
I think some of mine are pretty easy, actually. We thought you'd get tired of hearing one of our voices, so we'd switch off. But since we're doing it each round, I don't think we're tired of Phil's voice yet, but I'll take over anyways. So this item is another sort of streamlining process item. This was just kind of an overview of some of the direction that we got from council when we were going through our commercial uses tables. So we had a couple uses that we reduced the level of review from a conditional use permit, which are those items that go all the way through planning commission for review and action, to an administrative use permit. And those are discretionary items that go before our administrative hearing officer, which is our community development director. And with this zoning code update, if you recall, we are changing some of that process where it doesn't always require a hearing. It only requires a hearing if somebody requests one, either the applicant or one of the notified neighborhood people that might be affected. So this really is a streamlined process. Some of those uses that were called out during our commercial use discussion were laundromats. They don't have as much of an effect on neighborhoods as they used to in the 60s when our original code sprung forth for our city. Caretakers units for certain types of projects that need that overnight visibility. Horticultural specialties with outdoor sales, we reduced to an administrative use permit. Warehousing and wholesaling, we've honed the zones where those are allowed, and so an administrative use permit was more appropriate for that. And production breweries as well, because again, we've honed sort of the zoning districts where those are allowed and no longer need an additional level of review. Again, still a discretionary permit, so still has the ability to be reviewed by staff and any conditions placed on it that it needs to function properly or respond to any neighborhood concerns. We also reduced a level of review in the industrial zone for contract construction services. There was some discussion that in the industrial zone, outdoor contract construction services would not need a use permit, and that is the zone where those uses are more preferred, and so we did change that to an allowed use. We're going to pause for discussion on that item.
Okay, thank you. I'll start my right. Any questions, any comments?
Nope, I'm good. Good. Thank you.
You're good?
Looks good to me. I thought I proposed some of these before. I thought we already discussed them.
Yeah.
So they look familiar.
Okay. Anything
else? Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I know we went through the list of all these things a while back, and I'm good with this. This is good.
Councilmember Peak, anything?
This I am also happy with.
Yes, I as well am happy, very happy that we're reducing time and cost to applicants for routine things like this. And we have great confidence in our community development director to make good decisions. Open to the public.
Any way to maybe add one item like home-based business where you can actually legally have somebody at your house, would say you're an accountant or a CPA or something, and you can have one employee at your house? We still haven't addressed that anywhere. Thank you.
Thank you. It's an interesting comment. I don't know if it pertains to this specific recommendation here.
Not necessarily. We do, for our home occupations, we do limit off-site employees coming to the home as just an allowed as part of your home occupation. That's to ensure sort of neighborhood character. We do have an administrative use permit process to allow on-site employees for home occupations.
Okay, got it. And an AUP is easier than a CUP, so it's reasonably efficient in terms of
correct. It does allow for some neighborhood notification to ensure that we're maintaining adequate parking and character and nature of business, but it's a simplified process.
Got it. Okay, so I think you see that we're all comfortable with this.
Yes,
with this change.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move to number six regarding changes to the or updates to the tree ordinance.
I think I have the easy ones because I think you guys have already reviewed all of these in detail. So the next, we did incorporate some changes to the tree ordinance based on council discussion a couple meetings ago. The discussion really focused around the process and fees for trees that had died due to natural causes. We did eliminate the arborist verification for that dead tree. I think we all knew that the tree in front of the senior center was no longer living. And then you did explore some replanting requirements instead of paying fees for those types of trees. So this is where the code was updated. It's a couple different sections of the code, one of them in Chapter 3, which is the bulk of our native tree regulations, where we did have dead tree removals, died from natural causes or exempt from permit fees, but still subject to mitigation. And then we do clarify in our mitigation section that the mitigation is a planting of one 15-gallon native tree on the site. And that the director can determine that the tree has indeed died. Any discussion on this item?
Okay, start on the left. Any?
No discussion on this one. I'm really happy that we're moving forward with adjusting the tree rate ordinance and looking forward to more dialogue next year.
I had a brief discussion with Mr. Lewis on this one. So if somebody might come in and say, hey, I've got a dead tree and I want it removed and, you know, have it handled in this way, and maybe it's not obvious that it's dead or diseased or dying, there's still a provision that, I mean, we can require it basically on discretion, require and say, no, didn't get an arborist. So that'll end the argument.
Yes, that's correct. So because it's up to the community development director, if there is ambiguity or uncertainty, he can request additional information.
All right. All right. Well, great. I think it's good.
Okay. Any comments?
I'm good with it. And if an arborist report is required, that would be the responsibility of the property owner to provide it, right?
Correct.
Good. Yeah, that's all good.
Okay. Councilmember Newsom? Okay, and I'm glad we've been able to make these changes fairly quickly. And like Councilmember Peake said, I look forward to having a more in-depth discussion in early next year. Members of the public wishing to speak.
Sorry, this is a great improvement to the tree problem ordinance. But let's pick on the senior center for a minute. If they have to replace a 15-gallon native tree on site, it may require them to actually now have to bring in a backhoe, dig up the old one, replace soil to put one in. I'm not so sure.
Yeah, the replacement in general is up to, the placement on the property is up to property owner, although I don't know if we have a different rule for heritage trees.
I think for the heritage tree, we were looking for a similar, street tree location. The senior center has removed that tree and ground the stump out. In previous iterations of our code, we have required a minimum 24-inch box up to a 36-inch box replacement tree for those types of trees. We did do the 15-gallon because you can, in theory, get a hole dug.
Yeah.
Maybe not in the summer with some of our soils, but you can realistically do that without large equipment.
Yeah. Little digging around, they can find places around the roots to plant that 15-gallon. Got it. Thank you. Okay, I think we're good on that. Let's go to multifamily.
So our next item is something that we haven't necessarily discussed, although it definitely relates to sort of state requirements for reducing VMT and providing opportunities for neighborhoods to have proximity to some goods and services that maybe don't exist in their particular neighborhood. So our current proposed zoning code does have some added flexibility within our multifamily zones to allow for small-scale commercial uses. These are fairly limited. They're limited in size to what they can be, certain of them. So these are kind of like a neighborhood store. They do have to be on an arterial or collector road. So these are maybe think like South El Camino or North El Camino, where they're dominated by a residential and multifamily zones. You could incorporate a small, more commercial space into that development along those streets. So we looked at sort of small scale gathering spaces. These are things that sometimes religious facilities do in residential neighborhoods anyways, and they do those through a use permit. This could be a standalone type facility or something where it was shared between a multifamily complex and the general public. Again, small scale restaurants like a cafe or some retail stores. So this is what that looks like in the code. So you can see those eating and drinking establishments. We thought of also fitness facilities that might be a small yoga studio, or it might be a fitness facility as part of a multifamily development that would also be open to the public. Personal services. So these are small scale, barbershop type uses and general retail that is less than 2,000 square feet. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Councilmember Newsom, any questions?
I'm going to opt out of answering due to a possible conflict.
Okay.
This looks good to me.
Okay. Anyone on the left? Okay. I guess my only question is the state pushes you to have more housing and make sure you got everything zoned for enough housing. This would actually allow a small scale business to go into an multifamily zone place, and the state's okay with that, right?
The state is. What the state mostly regulates are our sites that are identified in our housing element for housing, so we can't sort of downzone, but we can build other things around them. There is actually a state law for qualifying housing projects that allows the addition of commercial uses, because the state sees that as a potential viable add for financing. So this is somewhat aligned with state law in that regard.
Okay. And if you provide services right in a neighborhood, it does reduce vehicle trips. So I'm not sure how, you know, much this will be utilized, but I'm encouraged that we're offering flexibility. So thank you. Any members of the public wishing to comment? Okay, seeing none approach, we're going to bring that back, and I think you've got our endorsement on that. Let's go to number 8, downtown outdoor amplified sound.
This is our final item. We do have a number of bands and a number of indoor-outdoor spaces as part of our downtown. Our current code actually requires approval of an administrative use permit every time that you have outdoor amplified sound on a regular basis. And so we wanted to allow certain bands and music and activities in our downtown that create a level of vibrancy outright without requiring that permit. So we are proposing some language that would exempt certain areas in downtown from that administrative use permit requirement for outdoor amplified sound. We did add a qualifier that this does not exempt the discretionary permit for any properties that are abutting or adjacent to a single family or multifamily zoning district. We don't want to create additional incompatibilities. We just want to allow for some of those businesses that are against the freeway or within our core downtown area, the opportunity of having a regular band without going through a discretionary permit process.
Okay, thank you. Any comments on the left, on the right? Okay. Okay, go ahead, Councilmember Peak.
Besides like live music, like little speakers in downtown park or around, you know, ambiance type things, does this concern that, or is this more like a Garden City band on the creek or the new brewery across the street? Is that more what we're looking for? Is it like, or if someone has just like a speaker, a Bose speaker outside their dress shop, or they have the city wants to put fun tinkly music around Sunken Gardens?
It is technically both. So it's anything that's amplified.
Okay, good question, though, in the sense of, I mean, there's some minimal thing, is there's not some decibel level threshold, but basically using amplified sound falls under this.
I think if it was really low decibel and it matched our noise ordinance, it'd be hard to call it amplified if it's something really, really minor. But in general, anything that uses a speaker or amplification.
This is more if you have you invite a band to play on the back deck of Momotaro Ramen or wherever like that.
Yeah, or if you had louder outdoor speakers as part of your ambiance for your eating area.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, all right, thank you very much. I believe that's the last item for us to discuss. Any member of the public wishing to comment? Okay, seeing none approach, I think you've got our guidance on that. And it was just looking for guidance and direction. You will bring back actual ordinance language at another point, correct?
And just to summarize, and for all those who are listening out there, you can see the whole draft code posted online for review at www.atascadero.org/ZCU. We have the whole draft code on our website right now. We will integrate your direction into the draft code. We do plan to go to Planning Commission October 6th and come back here October 27th, which would put us at a second reading November 10th and being effective December 10th. And all in between that time, 2 weeks from now, we'll be with you with the general plan and a final EIR as well. And this multi-year project is coming to a close. So I appreciate all of your hard work and your patience as we've struggled through this, but it's been a process, but I think it's been a good process.
All right. Thank you. And those were the soothing sounds of the voice of Mr. Phil Dunsmore. So thank you, Phil. I'm sorry, we're going to proceed on to our next item. Item H2, discussion of council compensation and benefits. And I'm not sure if I'm turning this over to Mr. Lewis or to Rachel Hunter, our human resources director. Looks like Rachel's got the microphone, so that's where we're headed. Okay.
Okay. All right. So, I had to kick out Chief Bryson here for a sec. So during the July 14th council meeting, council asked for an informational report on compensation and benefits for elected officials. So that's what we're going to cover real quick. If it wants to move. No. Where am I pointing this? There. Okay, there we go. So before we can talk about compensation, we do need to establish where a council member falls in our rules and regulations, and if they are an employee. So an employee is, per the FLSA, is someone permitted to work for an employer, and it clearly excludes an individual who holds public office. And then on top of that, our personnel system rules state that an employee is a person who occupies a position within the city service and is appointed by the appointing authority, in this case, the city manager. The city manager appoints all city employees, except the city attorney, and this was written back when the city attorney was on staff, and appointments reserved by the city council. So all people considered employees are appointed by the city manager. So what does that make a council member? A council member is elected by the citizens of Atascadero and not appointed by the appointing authority, in this case, the city manager. Their benefits are included in the city ordinance, not in a negotiated MOU or bargaining agreement, employment agreement. And there's our awesome council right there looking to get to work. Okay, so now the exciting part. City Ordinance 591 talks about the wages for our elected officials. These wages were updated in 2017. Prior to 2017, they were updated in 1986. So they were well due for an update in 2017 when they got the update. So each position there is listed in Ordinance 591. Council members also have the option of their retirement plan. A full-time employee does not have the option on where, if they're enrolled in CalPERS or not, they're automatically enrolled. A council member does have an optional plan membership, so they can enroll in CalPERS or in a FICA substitute. And you can see the rates for those there. Excuse me. We have a FICA substitute because the city of Atascadero does not pay into Social Security. So we have to have another option for our part-time employees and our council members. So you can see the big difference is the elected official contribution, and then of course the city contributions, depending on if the member chooses CalPERS or the FICA substitute. Insurance is optional for council members. It is required for all city employees to be covered under our health insurance, but it is optional for council members. The city covers the cost of medical and life insurance for the member only. So if the council member decides to add on spouse or dependents, they would need to pay out of pocket for that difference in premium. For dental and vision, the city covers the official, the spouse, and dependents, or whoever they choose to enroll in each of those plans. Again, if you're a full-time employee, if you enroll your family in medical, they're automatically enrolled in dental, vision, and life, but the ordinance allows for council members to pick and choose what they are putting their people in, and if they choose to pay for that coverage. And last but not least, the city does offer a post-retirement health benefit, which stipends $200 per month to a council member who has retired from CalPERS or a similar retirement plan and has served 8 consecutive years on the council or as an elected official, and they have to draw that retirement within 6 months of separating. This benefit is listed in the resolution for non-represented management, confidential employees, the resolution that covers that employee workforce. After doing research for this project, we have identified that this should not be housed in the compensation resolution. It should actually be in an ordinance. I looked back as far as I could, and this is the only mention of council in this resolution all the years back, and it is the only time council is presented in the resolution, is this one item. All right, so that's actually all I have. It's a very short presentation.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to start with Councilmember Newsom because you had asked for this to be put on the agenda, and so I'd like to start with you.
Appreciate it. Thank you to the staff and all the hard work and the research that needed to be done on it. As you know, council compensation of benefits has not really been addressed but a handful of times over the years. And I think it's important with a vacant seat that's coming forward that the public understand the benefits that are afforded to a council member as well as what has been intended. I know that the 2015 ordinance, when it was originally created, had mentioned that the intent was to make sure that the elected officials receive the same benefits as the city employees. I know it's also challenging because city employee and council member are not one and the same. And I've asked this to be put on the agenda, one, to evaluate the changes that should happen. I think when you come into office, we make decisions on 4-year and 2-year intervals, depending on when we're elected to office. And there is a lot of inconsistencies with the ordinance and the benefits that we would receive on the day that we took office, following to the day that we're leaving office. And so a couple of things I wanted to address in here is that the draft or the resolution done in 2025 had stipulated that there would be retiree benefits. It alluded to the insurance, but it did not specify in writing what criteria needed to be met to be listed as a retiree for health insurance benefits. Retiree health insurance benefits are afforded to all city employees, but technically we're not considered city employees by definition, but not defined in an ordinance or a resolution. I'm asking for clarification or explanation of that.
Sure. So not all retirees are afforded retiree health insurance. There is a criteria that needs to be met, and that is they, very similar to some of the other criteria, is they have to participate immediately upon separation. They can't leave, go somewhere else, and come back to our plan. They have to be continuously enrolled in the program. Again, no on and off the retiree. They must be under the age of 65, not eligible for Medicare, and also have no access or not be eligible to any other group health insurance. So if their spouse or even they go into the private sector and have access to group insurance, they cannot plan to stay on ours. It is not listed anywhere because it's not a guaranteed benefit. When somebody elects retiree health insurance, they sign a piece of paper that says, I understand this is year to year based on our insurance plan. And it's up to the insurance committee and our renewal process to understand if that is something we can keep affording our retirees. So it is not listed anywhere because we can't guarantee that that's going to be a benefit we can continue. So it is something that we have had for many years, but again, it's not listed anywhere because it is not a guaranteed benefit.
So I guess my clarifying question is that information provided to council when they're provided with their insurance benefits upon placement onto that policy?
It is not on a yearly basis because again, council is a little bit different because you're not required to be on insurance. Council is the only ones that are required, not required to be on insurance when they're working or here. Automatically employees get added to health insurance, whether they want to be or not, as part of our plan. So not necessarily, retiree health insurance is not typically discussed at any new employee orientation. That's not a benefit that we bring to the table from day one. Typically, it doesn't come up in conversation.
But it's written in the resolution of 2025 of what retiree benefits are, and that that 8-year mark has to be met.
That is the $200 stipend.
Correct. For a retiree health insurance benefit. Is that not the same?
No, they are completely different things. So the $200, you can use it for any type of insurance. You can use it for a life insurance policy. You can use it for another type of policy. That is a $200 stipend per month that a retiree can get if they as a reimbursement for a insurance. So what needs to happen with that is if they get a private plan, they will basically send the city a reimbursement request for that $200 a month. It is not retiree health insurance and really doesn't have any correlation with that.
However, when that resolution was done in closed session addressing and tied to other bargaining unit negotiations and was written into that plan, the intent at that time was a little bit more. That intent or clarification in writing was not established. And I know that this city staff has had conflicts with how to approach that question. So I'm asking for it to be, I guess, decided by the council body to make sure that we are all aware of all benefits going forward and to clarify that council does not meet that requirement. And that that is not an option available and to be written into the ordinance. So there is no differencing for staff that come after.
So the $200 benefit is for council. That it absolutely is. The retiree health to stay on our health plan is not eligible for council. So we're talking about two separate benefits here.
Okay. And What I'm asking is that it be clarified and written into the ordinance so there is no,
I don't know, but you identified in your report, though, that there was some language that shouldn't be in the resolution because council should not really be included with the management non-represented employees. Correct. In that resolution. So in terms of clarity, that would be one thing that should be clarified, correct?
Yes, I found copies of the management resolution back to 2005, and it did mention council for this $200 monthly stipend way back in 2005. It did not have any other language in there, so I'm not sure what the intent was in 2015 versus 2005, but it did go way back to then, and it really should go in the ordinance because all council benefits should be under the ordinance. Yeah.
So, Mayor, as a result of this, just to be clear, I appreciate that. One, I think it's very good to show the community that the council members do get some level of benefit for your work. I think most of you lose money serving on the city council. You're practically volunteers, and this is just a bit of change to cover your time and your expenses. But I think coming out of this, I think it is clear. I would like to move that $200 to the ordinance and make it very clear that for purposes of retiree health pool, to be in our retiree health pool, council members are not employees. There is not a city in our area that recognizes a council member who leaves the council as a person who's eligible for the retiree health, nor most of the cities are in PERS. Does PERS allow that if you weren't a full-time employee in city service? And so we certainly could make that clear in 251 and bring that back.
I appreciate it. And the reason I bring it up is because AB 2134 is coming forward. It's another legislation of Family-Friendly City Council Act.